meeting for June 19th, 2012 to order, and ask if Edie, can you take roll call, please?
Councilperson Gary?
Here.
Cutterback? Williams?
Here.
Camp?
Present.
Davis? Campbell?
Here.
Hanford?
Here.
And as both members, Cutterback and Davis explained last week, they will not be here tonight. They're on vacation. So with that said, please join me for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
First order of business this evening is proclamation. Proclamation for Speed Week. And as most, if not everybody in the audience is aware, the city of Monroe is, in my opinion, blessed to have not only the fairgrounds, but Evergreen Speedway. And out at the Speedway, most weekends, many of us hear the roaring engines of the cars and that are speeding around the track. And I tell you, it's a lot of fun. If you haven't been out for a while, I would recommend that you visit, because we've had some extraordinary individuals take over the running of the Speedway. Tracy and Doug Hobbs, who are here tonight, good evening. And I just want to commend them on the job that they've done in bringing that Speedway back to really a great adventure for families and for individuals alike. So, so welcome tonight, and I'd like to share a proclamation with regards to Speed Week. Whereas Monroe has a long history of automobile racing starting in 1954, when an unpaved horse track within the confines of the Evergreen State Fairground was converted for use in automobile racing, giving birth to the Evergreen Speedway. Whereas in 1957, another racetrack was born when local visionaries carved Monroe's original dirt racetrack out of the hillside, creating Sky Valley Raceway. Whereas Evergreen Speedway is the only NASCAR track in Washington State and is known as the Super Speedway of the West. Whereas the Richard Petty Driving Experience Stock Car Driving School will be making its first ever appearance at Evergreen Speedway June 25th to June 30th. Whereas the Coors Light Summer Showdown, the largest race of its kind in Monroe in over a decade, will have over 150 race cars from five states in Canada competing on June 29th and 30th. Whereas on June 28th, the Coors Light Fan Fest will feature a driver meet and greet in conjunction with the super late model practice on the big track. And whereas on June 29th, there will be qualifying for the Summer Showdown with NASCAR, Les Schwab Tire Street Stops, NASCAR Foster Press Mini Stops, Outlaw Compacts, and Twin 25 Lap. And whereas June 30th will include a last chance qualifying race for the Summer Showdown, Pro 4 Alliance Series, Pro 4 Truck Tour, and the 200 Lap Summer Showdown, all on the 5/8 mile. And whereas the Monroe Historical Society is commemorating the history of stock car racing in Monroe with a salute to the Sky Valley Speedway on June 30th in building number 501 to view displays and cars and meet early racers, mechanics, trophy girls, and audience members. Now, therefore, I, Robert G. Zimmerman, Mayor of the City of Monroe, do hereby proclaim the week of June 25th through June 30th, 2012, as Speed Week in Monroe, and I urge all citizens to celebrate Monroe's racing history by attending the many events being held at Evergreen Speedway and the commemoration sponsored by the Monroe Historical Society. The adventure starts here for sure. I have an original copy I'd like to present to both of you, if you might come up and... Let me just
see over here.
Thank you very much and
thank
welcome.
You. Thank you.
What a wonderful job you guys have been doing, and we look forward to Speed Week.
All right.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
That's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, well, moving on to the next item in our agenda, we have a public hearing this evening. The public hearing is on the 2012 Comprehensive Plan Amendments Proposed Land Use Element Text for First Air Field North Kelsey Development Plan, Downtown Master Plan in East Monroe. Paul, you have three slides. You wanted to slow the show for that before we open up? There's a spot here.
Thank you, Mayor. Public hearing tonight is to consider three comp plan amendments, First Airfield, North Kelsey Downtown, and East Monroe. And this public hearing is being held because there have been some changes made to these applications since the Planning Commission held a public hearing in April. So we are holding this hearing to vet any additional comments in this formal setting from the public. And I'm going to just go through these three with three slides very briefly. The first one has to do with First Air Field, which is about 65 acres total. And if approved, the result will be, as you see in that purple color, limited open space airport. Today, most of that land is already zoned LOSA, or open space. There's a small part in the upper right part, just below that R25 parcel, and a triangle to the west, which are being considered for a change of land use in zoning to accommodate this airport amendment. The second amendment has to do with North Kelsey in the red, and the downtown district in the dark brown. That Highway 2 is splitting those two areas. You can see it running across the screen. This involves changes to the comprehensive plan in terms of detaching these as regulatory instruments from that comp plan and changing some language to reflect what is happening and what will continue to happen with North Kelsey, and some changes to the downtown future development, downtown master plan. And again, being brief, but any questions that come up during the discussion later, we can come back. The last one is the East Monroe, which is shown in the I don't have good luck with these things. I can tell you that right now.
For some reason.
There he is. Who's got it? That LOS just above there, that's shoreline area. It's about 18 acres. The red area, the GC, is what's being proposed for a change of land use and zoning from limited open space to commercial. What you see here is a total today of about 80 acres of limited open space. And just for the record, there is one other parcel in Monroe that is zoned limited open space, which would be the Cadman property, which the city will inherit eventually. Right now we have a total of about 330 acres of limited open space. If this change takes place, the city will have about 280, I believe, acres of limited open space. But we can talk more about this if you wish later, but there's the basic picture of what these three amendments are all about. Any questions from council? Mayor?
No, nothing at this time. Go ahead then and open up for public testimony. And currently I only have one individual. Signed up.
There might be on the list.
Okay. All right. Well, we will begin with Mr. Schilling.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, council members. I'm Steve Schilling, 32221 124th Street Southeast, Salton, Washington, representing St. Mary of the Valley Catholic Church and the 1,112 registered family members. First, I'd like to thank the council for the recent vote on excluding the name of the Hill Street Extension. And changing that name to a more effective name. You know, there's an old saying that when you're going to do something that there's no substitute for good information properly applied. And so with that in mind, I'd like to read this this cover letter that has been drafted by the parishioners at St. Mary's of the Valley into the record, if I may, concerning the former Hill Street Extension. To the Honorable Robert Zimmerman, Mayor of the City of Monroe, and all members of Monroe City Council, in the interest of community cooperation and with a desire to avoid an adversarial, I might add, expensive relationship between St. Mary of the Valley Catholic Church and the City of Monroe concerning the six-year transportation improvement program, 2013-2018, especially that portion of the plan previously known as the Hill Street Extension, please consider the following.
Mr. Schilling?
Yeah.
I just want to, and we'll make sure that your time isn't gone here. The discussion portion tonight is dealing with the three items there specifically that we were talking about.
Right.
And I believe that your topic is more geared towards the TIP or the transportation portion of the plan. So I just wanted the council to be aware. I don't want to interrupt you anymore while we're here. I'd like to have you continue speaking, but for council's sake, I believe that this may be more geared towards the previous items that we discussed, which was the Hill Street extension and changing that.
The proposal we're going to present does terminate downtown.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm sorry.
The background is in March of this year, Mayor Zimmerman met with Father Bloom, parish pastor, to explain the purpose of the street extension plan and the impact it would have on church property. Subsequently, the mayor and staff met with members of the building commission representing the St. Mary's Parish community. The purpose of the meeting was to inform the parish leadership of the city's intention to extend Hill Street across church property and adjoining school district sports fields by right of eminent domain, thus creating East-West Collector Street to the downtown core. The representatives, not hearing any alternate plans to the proposal, developed a concept that would avoid taking a church property and connect a Collector Street business core in a manner consistent with the downtown master plan. This concept was discussed with Monroe School District Board Member Nancy Pierce during a sidebar at the City School Board Information Meeting in May. And subsequently, Mr. Pierce alluded to the concept during Monroe City Council public hearing June 5th. 2012 concerning the six-year plan. It's our recommendation that the attached concept sheet and rationale for the Columbia Street Collector be formalized by the necessary city departments, adopted by the City Council as an amendment to the City of Monroe's Downtown Master Plan, and officially designated as the City's East-West Collector Street, south of State Route 2. In addition, it's our recommendation of the final vote on downtown master plan should be tabled until the department reviews are complete and presented to the council for action. And we thank you for your consideration. If you look at the concept sketch, in brief, the plan begins with a roundabout at Blueberry Lane down King Street. This is a full 60-foot right-of-way. And then travels east on West Columbia Street, which is a full 60-foot right-of-way. Takes out three small residential units to Short Street and comes through a marginal commercial building into a roundabout at Main Street and Fremont. And continues through Fremont to connect to the Fremont Downtown Improvement Site. I've listed a number of advantages to this plan. You have a copy of it in front of you. For that, I'll conclude my remarks tonight. Thank you.
Sorry for the interruption. I think you appreciate the...
Thank you.
Okay, moving on here. Next on the list is Mr. Anderson.
Okay.
Lowell Anderson, 129 East Rubemont Drive, Monroe, Washington. The Rogers and Anderson letter of June 14, 2012 to the mayor and council members in your position. State our opposition to East Monroe Amendment to the City of Monroe Comprehensive Plan and Concomitant Rezone. By taking action tonight, you're putting the cart before the horse instead of waiting for the outcome of the EIS appeal, July 19, 2012. We look forward to the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Rogers.
Jeff Rogers. I live at 127 East Rubemont Drive in Monroe. And my comments are directed at the East Monroe Comprehensive Plan Amendment. I recognize my comments and probably a lot of other comments tonight aren't going to dissuade the council from its path toward proceeding with the comprehensive plan amendment and the rezone. It's pretty clear that's a path that you've been on for some time, and the work that we've had over the past several years is probably not going to make any impression on any of you. But we obviously want to preserve our rights to make sure the record is complete. So when we appeal, our concerns are included in the record. So bear with me for just a few minutes. First, in terms of the EIS, the city's determination of significance from last July identified 11 separate environmental issues that are adversely affected by the proposed rezone. In fact, it stated unequivocally that the rezone is likely to have significant adverse impact on the environment. That's essentially what the determination of significance by the city determined. And as you well know, shortly after the appeal rights, where the applicant didn't appeal, the city did a 180 and proceeded with a phased EIS. I don't know a whole lot about land use, but I don't think a concept of a phased EIS is essentially to ignore a determination of significance, which in fact what this phase EIS essentially did. So from my perspective, it's a flawed EIS, and we intend to pursue that as appropriate. From our perspective, we recognize that until there's a specific project, you can't analyze all the environmental issues, but you have some basis to identify 11 elements that raise issues. And before a rezone is implemented, there should be some basic sense would a rezone in and of itself present environmental challenges From our perspective, it does. Secondly, from a governance perspective, whether you're governing a corporation, whether you're governing a municipality, I think one of your responsibilities is to ask the right question at the right time. And from my perspective, I don't think the right questions have been asked. I don't think the right answers have been given. We're befuddled in terms of the rationale for proceeding with this. A lot of supposition why. It's not for me to speculate. But I do think there's been a number of issues identified, and this body should be asking the right questions in terms of the issues. And I think that's important. Obviously, your job is not to represent a narrow interest. Your job is to represent the public interest, the broad public interest. From our perspective, my perspective, once this rezone is complete, this body, both you individually and collectively, are going to be accountable for that decision and the consequences that flow from that decision. So I think that's important for you to take that into your discussions and deliberations. This will fundamentally reshape the allowable uses for that property. It will fundamentally affect those of us who live on the bluff and puts us at risk from our... I've said it before, anytime there's a heavy rain, I don't sleep that well. And I can tell you, when there's a commercial development down there that puts asphalt down, my sleep is even going to be less, because we all know what happens when you put impervious surfaces. The water goes somewhere, and it's going to go up against our property, our steep slopes that presents risk. So once again, you're accountable for this decision, both individually and collectively. There's a number of questions. The Department of Ecology has indicated their wetland studies that you're relying on are out of date and should be updated prior to the rezone. FEMA is obviously in the process of updating the flood zone maps. Those are going to be issued probably next March. I think it'd be smart to wait to see whether this is in a 100-year floodplain. We all know it's flooded four or five times in the last 15, 20 years. This presents serious SEPA and Growth Management Act questions, whether protecting the wetlands, frequently flooded areas and the steep slopes, among other issues. There's traffic issues with Highway 2. This is properly zoned limited open space because there's no public facilities, no public services. The millions of dollars that it's going to take to bring those is going to make this economically infeasible for commercial development for some time. I think the other question, I know I'm a few seconds over here, and I've said this to other members of the council. From my perspective, what's been disappointing is that the neighbors haven't been engaged in this process. Yeah, we can come to these public hearings and give 5 minutes of testimony, but there's never been an engagement by your body to us to say, this is why we're doing it, so we can understand. It's been a mystery. Mysteries are fine in religions, but they're not fine in public bodies. So from my perspective, I think it's a shame that we've lost an opportunity for you to sit down with us, all of us here, and say, this is why we're proceeding. So I'll close my comments. I'm sure there's others that are going to add to it, but thanks for listening. Like I said, I think you're on a path to do it, but you're going to be accountable for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Eller?
Clive Eller, 21804 Calhoun Road. Boy, you guys know better than I, there are pages and pages of reasons why you shouldn't do this. So, in my mind, possibly others, the only reason could be is speculative profit. If money is a consideration, think of the hundreds of thousands of dollars it's going to cost the adjacent landowners in property devaluation. You know in your hearts you shouldn't do this. Listen to your hearts and don't do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McCammon?
Hi.
Chad McCammon, 2164 Calhoun Road. First of all, I want to start off by saying that I recognize that we think that there was actually a public hearing on these text changes to the comprehensive plan prior to this, but it was snuck onto the agenda 1 or 2 days ahead of the meeting that was supposed to be the public meeting for the council, or to go over the comprehensive plan changes. I was at that meeting. I was one of about 20 people that even knew it was on that agenda ahead of time. So I don't think that it was fair to come out with the first reading prior to having a true public hearing where the whole public knew that that was going to be an item to discuss. Second, I'll get into that this is about the text changes to the comprehensive plan, so I'll try to focus on those text changes. In the text changes, it talks about that the area is impacted by wetlands while not in the 100-year floodplain, is subject to local flooding due to restricted drainage. First of all, yes, it's not in the current adopted floodplain map, but it has been shown in the 100-year floodplain map on the one that will probably be adopted. There's two other versions of floodplain maps that are more current than the one that is adopted that do show it in the 100-year floodplain. It's also known to flood quite often. So I think the best available science is that it's known to flood and will be considered in a 100-year floodplain as soon as the next map's adopted, and that we have to use that logic. The second part on the text change that says it's due to restricted drainage, that is not true. The reason it floods is not restricted drainage. It's the fact that there's a stream that ties the Skykomish River on the east and the west end of the property. At flood stages, the water goes in through the culverts onto the property, on one end of the property, the east side, and then it flows out the west side. It's not restricted drainage. It's a stream that ties to the river. The next thing in the text is it talks about a gateway presence. Yet there's no gateway zoning in place. So if this is rezoned as a commercial, anything could be built at this time. There's nothing that would hold the landowner to follow any certain code specific to any gateway at this time. So I don't know how that text can be in unless there is actually a gateway zone. And then it also doesn't make sense for it to be a gateway, as it has no direct tie to the city. It's separated by a large hill or a small mountain. I don't know what you want to call it. And if the bypass for the highway comes in, it's going to cut it off even more from the city. There's not a direct tie to the city. And then the text talks about there would be a roundabout to capture those that would otherwise bypass Monroe. Well, it may capture a few people that want to stop at whatever fast food restaurant goes in there that would have otherwise driven all the way through town to eat at maybe a nicer establishment in town and spread the wealth to all the restaurants in town instead of the one fast food chain that they can get off on a roundabout and then go on the bypass around the entire city. And they would also miss all the other stores and commercial buildings that they would have otherwise driven past. Because I know when you're coming out of the mountains, there's not a lot of choices until you hit Monroe. So it could be just an easy excuse for people to get a hamburger and continue on their way instead of really profit the city. And it also really adds to urban sprawl. If commercial development goes down there, what's going to stop it from proceeding all the way to Salton? I mean, you can look at the towns of Salton and Gold Bar, and you can't tell where one stops and one ends. Well, we might be the tri-cities of Monroe, Salton, and Gold Bar with just continuous strip malls between. I think we need to just leave. We have a pretty good boundary right now, and I think that we should try to hold that boundary where it is. And I think that might be what the general public wants us to do. I don't know if the general public's really going to ask. I think that they should. Those are my comments on the actual text changes, and you've all heard all my other comments over the years. So but I appreciate the chance to speak up here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't have anybody else signed up at this time to speak during the public hearing, but as always, we'd like to open up to members of the audience who would like to address council. Certainly. If you would ask that you would give us your name and address for the record, that would be nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm Darlene Bolsetzer, and I've lived in on the bluff since 1968. I'm right above the driveway, right above the area there where the rezone's taking place. And I have seen when the river gets up, which it does quite frequently, that driveway is totally covered with water, and on each side of the driveway is water. And I've seen the residents have to go out by boat, and when that flood water isn't in there, there are also ponds right by in there, and there's groundwater that leaves in there during the winter, and it's a swampy area in there. So it's just, it's a regular wetland. And I can't see, right now it's limited open space, and they've had animals down here are grazing, and they've had crops, and I think that's what that property is good for. I can't see putting concrete or asphalt over groundwater or in a flood area when it's actually is limited open space, and why should it be changed to something that's not? That's it.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Council? Oh. Over there. Councilor Gary.
Thanks. Motion to close the public testimony portion.
Sorry. All right. Motion has been made by Councilor Gary and seconded by Councilor Williams to close the public testimony portion of the public hearing. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Council, any questions, comments, or staff? Councilmember Gamble.
So I saw in the packet here that we do have the recommendations as of right now. The hearing is on the 19th. The action currently is set up for the 10th.
Correct.
We're saying that we don't need to wait for that. So if the Planning Commission's recommendation is to wait for that, our recommendation. Commission suggested by consensus.
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Gamble, you're referring to the commission meeting a week or two ago.
June 11th.
Thank you. And just by consensus, they suggested that staff communicate to the council that their preference is to delay the action on the final action on the second reading on the comp plan amendments and rezoning, particularly for East Monroe, until after the appeal on the EIS is heard by the hearing examiner and he renders his decision, which would be in late July. The reason that was just forwarded informally because their recommendation was related to the East Monroe zoning, but had no relation to the environmental impact statement in terms of their action on agenda items for that night. But that was their consensus that suggestion be forwarded to you.
All right. And so I guess, my question is there any reason why we wouldn't?
Well, the question was asked of City Attorney Lell as to whether or not we were prohibited from taking action prior to that. So I'll let him answer that question as to whether we're prohibited. Answer the question of whether you want to or not. That's the question that you might answer or discuss and answer tonight. But City Attorney Lowell.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The specific question, as I understood it, as posed by staff, was whether the council was legally prohibited from voting on the comprehensive plan amendments during the pendency of the administrative appeal for the environmental secret determination. In my opinion, the answer is no. State law limits the extent to which you can take an action after the EIS has been issued, but imposes no similar prohibition for actions taken during the pendency of an appeal. So the short answer is you're not prohibited from voting on the amendments during that time. From my perspective, and I'll let staff correct me if I'm wrong with respect to the city's own adoption regulations and processes, but I don't believe there's any legal problem with postponing your vote on that. If that's a direction the council wants to go, I believe it's certainly within your prerogative to do that. The concern under state law would be that you still adopt all of your comprehensive plan amendments for this year simultaneously, because that is a state law mandate at GMA.
That was my next question, because I know that we separated them out because there is it's a perceived conflict of interest of one of the council members is through abundance of caution on one of the other ones, so we've separated them so they can be voted on separate. So we still should be doing them all in one. So if we delay, it would be for everything.
So yes, my understanding is that the council's preference is to segment out the individual amendments into distinct ordinances, one for the East Monroe proposal, one for North Kelsey, and one for the First Air Field. But to still consider those and adopt them and vote on them simultaneously. So as long as you do that, you would be within the mandate of state law under the GMA. So there's certainly no problem with that.
My personal opinion, I personally would like to, unless we're up again, I mean, I don't think we're up against it, I don't see harm in waiting until we get the ruling and then making the vote at that final action at that time.
We are up against, I thought, Brad or Paul, we're up against some deadline. What was the deadline that we're, was it our own internal deadline, or we have a deadline that we're trying to meet with regards to the comprehensive plan amendment?
It was an internally scheduled deadline from the beginning of the process. In fact, it got moved back sometime a little later than originally planned for. But the July 10th date is the first date that council can take action following the mandatory 60-day review by the state and other agencies. That's what determined that July 10th date. That was based on the process of the timing of the schedule in reaching up to that first reading back on May 1st.
There is no drop dead date that we have to have the decision made on the amendments.
No, just they all have to be made at the same time.
This all have to be made at the same time.
In this calendar year.
Okay, so I was going to refer to the city attorney about that. That has to be done in this calendar year, right?
Correct. Your amendments to the comprehensive plan are going to have to occur and be considered cumulatively simultaneously for the day here.
So to delay one, really we're delaying all of three.
To consider all revisions.
What effects or what impacts would that have on the other amendment applications and so forth?
I don't believe it would have any impact on the North Kelsey downtown application. First Air Field is in the midst of somewhere in the process of a transaction where the Darrell Havoc, Dr. Havoc would remain, I believe, involved as in the ownership, but I don't know what impact there would be to that group with a delay, nor do I know the impact to the East Monroe property owners.
City Attorney Lell, if action was to be taken on the 10th to approve, and then later in the month a decision was handed down that stated that something was wrong with the EIS, what impacts would that have on I guess my question is there adverse impacts to making a decision prior to that other than having to return and review the EIS statement?
No, we can always rescind previously passed. That's the council's preference. And also, we move to reconsider it depending on the time.
Councilmember Aguirre?
I think that was my question. I wanted to understand what you just said. Move to rescind what? I didn't.
Well, my understanding of the mayor's question is whether the council could take any remedial action if an adverse SEPA decision came down
exactly
after the council originally voted. I'd be happy to look into that and provide a definitive response to you after the meeting, but my strong assumption is that the council would have the ability to rescind its repeal its original ordinance, particularly if it was done in a short period of time after its original vote.
And even though we were considering three at the same time, you would have to rescind all,
no,
absolutely everything, or we would just be talking about the Eastern Monroe section?
Yes, and again, I'll be happy to provide more definitive advice if it's the council's preference, but that, I don't believe that you would be required to repeal or rescind all three ordinances, or even necessarily that you'd be required to repeal or rescind the ordinance for which the environmental challenge had been made. But I don't believe it would affect the other two ordinances at all. They're completely separate, and as I understand, they weren't covered by the same legal challenge or the environmental concern in any event.
And given that it's the EIS versus the comprehensive plan text change, I would have a problem with the 10th, and you're going to get the same result one way or the other, regardless of which day you do it. So.
Well, again, the council is clear with its legal ability to make a decision on the 10th, and it's clear within its ability to postpone action until a future council meeting, as long as the council is bundling these comprehensive plan amendment proposals and voting on them simultaneously so that all of their impacts can be cumulatively addressed.
A separate process from the EIS appeal altogether, in which case I have no problem keeping it on the date that it's on. But if everybody else feels later is fine, then that's fine.
Paul, you said there was no other, there may not be no other impacts, but in fact we do have a North Kelsey project that could be impacted by a delay in these amendments in the form of a land sale and permit application.
It's possible, yes.
Okay, so there are other impacts too. Okay, any other questions for staff or comments?
Motion to approve closing the public hearing.
Motion has been made by Councilmember Gamble to close the public hearing.
Second.
And seconded by Councilmember Williams. Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. That does close the public hearing this evening on the comprehensive plan amendment proposals for 2012. We'll now move on to comments from citizens. This time is set aside for you to speak to City Council on any issues of any quasi-judicial matters subject to a public hearing. We ask that you provide your name and address for the record, and please limit your time to 5 minutes. And I do not have anybody at this time signed up to address Council. And so, as always, we'd like to open the mic up to members of the audience who might have a comment to Council. And seeing none, we will then move along to the next item, and that's the consent agenda. Do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Motions were made by Councilmember Williams, seconded by Councilmember Hanford, to approve the consent agenda. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. New business. Item number one, ordinance to issue 2012 GO refunding bonds. This is the first reading. And Diane.
Hello. As you know already, in 2010,
The city issued bonds in the amount of $11.3 million to cover the debt owed on the land known as North Kelsey. $6.5 million of those bonds are due this November 1st. The city's intent was to use the land, the money from the land sale to Sabie Corporation, who was going to build the Walmart, to use that money to pay off the bonds. But there was a lawsuit, the city prevailed, and then the people, it's called Friends of North Kelsey, have decided to appeal the lawsuit, and so that is delaying the closing of this land sale, so we will not have the money to pay those bonds, so we are proposing to refund just the $6.5 million worth of bonds by issuing new bonds for them that will be due in 3 years, but can be paid off earlier. The cost of doing this reissuance, if the bonds go to maturity, which is 3 years out, will be $333,000 to the city. If the appeals court goes through, we think in a year, and if we can get the land sale done right after that, and if we can get everything done within a year and call those bonds in a year, the additional cost will be reduced. It will only be $125,000 to the city, the cost of this delay. And so tonight is the first reading of the bond ordinance. I have here in the audience our bond underwriter, Dave Tregesser from D.A. Davidson & Company, and our bond counsel, Nancy Naris from Foster Pepper. They are here to answer any questions. Do you guys want to say anything? Just answer questions. It's kind of a straightforward financing situation.
Well, Diane and I are very relieved at the numbers. Although we're not excited about them, we're very relieved because our original, or Diane's original calculations were that this was going to be much, much worse for us. I guess we can say that we're taking advantage of the interest rates nationally because of how low they are. We're actually faring out much better than what we hoped.
Originally, I thought we were going to have to convert this to long-term bonds, but fortunately, our underwriter is able to work his magic, and he told me we were able to just turn it over to a three-year bond, which is a lot cheaper.
Absolutely. So, thank you for that. Appreciate it. Yeah, a lot of sweat over that one. I'm thinking about it. So, any questions or comments for Diane? If not, we'll entertain a motion to accept this first reading ordinance to issue 2012 GEO refunding bonds.
So moved.
Second.
All right. Motion's been made by Councilmember Gamble and seconded by Councilmember Hamford. I'm not sure if I had the light on first. Councilmember Gearing?
No, that's fine. Appreciate you guys being here tonight, too. With this, and you guys have been a number of times, since I've been here over the years with this kind of stuff, is there any kind of, and I'm assuming this happens, where you got to redo this so that you get the time frame that works? I mean, it's not, you're expecting it, it's going to come, it's just going to come later. Does that do anything ultimately to, the credit rating and stuff like that, that kind of stuff? So I do want to find out a little bit about that, regardless of where, before we move.
Yeah, good question. Dave Tregesser, Senior Vice President of D.A. Davidson. As part of this process, we'll be going back to get a credit rating. As you may recall, when the bonds were issued in 2010, we achieved an SP 1 plus credit rating for the LTGO bonds, which is a very high rating which allows us to market those bonds at low interest rates. We are in the document process stage right now. Preparing the official statement, other disclosure information. We'll be going back to the standard force with the presentation. Hopefully we can maintain the SP 1 plus rating, and my estimate in today's market, we won't be able to lock in the interest rates until late July under our current schedule and close late in July. Our current schedule, if we're able to maintain the SP 1 plus rating, I expect the interest rate to be approximately 1.5%. If it were down to not, it would be 1.75%. That's in today's market. And, of course, we're benefiting by all the calamities, the natural calamities in Europe and everything else that have kept long-term fixed rate and short-term fixed rate bonds very low, 40-year lows in our world. So, to answer your question, hopefully there's not going to be a change to the credit rating. We think that currently, as I've looked at the preliminary information, I don't expect one. The city's assessed valuation has decreased, you know, as part of the revaluation process pretty significantly over the last couple of years. That is a small negative. We'll be back and keeping your finance director in the loop as we go through this process and be back to the council for final passage of the delegation ordinance on the 10th, but we'll not be in the market to lock in interest rates until later in the month. So we can provide a final report to the council after that.
Great. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Councilmember Gamble?
No, that's not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Councilmember Williams?
Thank you, Mayor. Diane, you said best case scenario, this cost is about $125,000. Worst case scenario is $333,000. Is that money in the North Kelsey Fund now, or does that come out of the general fund, or where is that extra money coming from?
I'm hoping it comes from land sales in the North Kelsey area. If not, I mean, these are GO bonds, so the city's full faith and taxing authority is being pledged for these bonds. So if we do not get it from the land sales, it will come out of the general fund to property tax revenues.
Okay. So, and to go on that, while I appreciate your optimism, Mr. Mayor, I'm very frustrated that, in my opinion, a frivolous lawsuit designed to delay something has this much of an impact on a city that's already financially strapped. And so I'm glad it's not worse, but I just think it needs to be pointed out that this is something designed to delay. We're taking no consideration for $125,000 to $330,000 is going to come out of the city's general fund to cover this expense. So from that standpoint, I'm very frustrated with this process.
Councilmember Hammer?
I concur. I'm here as chairman as well.
Thank you. Okay. I concur. It is very frustrating. And as Diane pointed out, you know, we are hopeful. We do have opportunities that lie before us that give us room to be optimistic. But at the same time, this delay is going to cost the taxpayers one way or another. So it is very frustrating on that front. So, Councilmember Green?
I turned my light on.
Okay.
It was already in motion. So.
All right. Okay, seeing no other lights or hearing no other comments, we'll go ahead and take a vote on the motion. We need to read. No, we don't. Okay, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here tonight. Appreciate it. Well, something that we've been doing, I think, very well. Some might feel we're not doing enough. Some might feel we're doing we're having too many meetings. I enjoy them and appreciate them very much. Tonight we've invited to have before us two members of the Ethics Board here to talk a little bit tonight about Ethics Code Amendment pertaining to confidential information. So we have Aaron Williams here this evening, and I was told you wanted to introduce all the members of the Ethics Board here tonight. Right. I will let you have you go ahead and introduce our other guests.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate all your efforts to get the board back with the quorum. And it's been working very well. I appreciate the members and appreciated the old members that had left. Tonight I'm going to do a desk side briefing tonight. On this one, we're going to use your read-ahead copies and your attachments. These have to do with the Ethics Code at 2.52, and there's just two sections that are involved. and I'll introduce a brief description of them and then go into our rationale for each individual change on that one, and then open it up for discussions and then go into the next one on there. There's no major changes, it's just clarifying a lot of items on here. Pursuant to the authority granted in the Ethics Code, we were giving the ability to present recommended amendments to the exit code. We have really three of them. The first one, A, it's at .080B, and this is public officials, and it has to do with the specific complaints against a public official. We are recommending that you add a new paragraph 2 to this section and renumbering the remaining sections in the of this section of code. Below is a blank verbiage of the description of it. I'll recap that it just said that you will not disclose the contents of confidential information during the complaint process. And the wording is exactly as we have presented to you. B has to do with section point 040. On this one, it is the conflict of interest, COI, and it's the code of conduct for public officials and city employees. On this one, we had identified some ambiguities and administrative errors in posting some of this one, and we'd like to clear some of them up. The first recommended change is that you reinstate a paragraph F that was originally stated in Ordinance 025 of 2003. That's our baseline on posting to the Ethics Code. And this was effective as of December 2003, so we're going back just a little ways. And then on the second recommended change that we will do is we're recommending that you supersede and repeal the very last paragraph in the conflict of interest. Now we'll go into the discussions on each one of the sections, and I'll direct your attention to Exhibit A. Public officials, specific complaints against public officials. This new paragraph 2 complies with a request from the Monroe City Council to place the emphasis and compliance on the rule of not to discuss or place confidential information in the public domain. Also, in addition to this one statement in the code, we will do the implementing instructions in our procedural rules. We will give the public official the opportunity to disclose if there is any confidential information in the complaint. In the Ethics Code, you have a detailed definition of what confidential information contains at .020. And it's further described on the what confidential information code is at .060, disclosure prohibited. And I will open this up for discussions on this one recommended change. Questions, answers.
Councilmember Geary.
Thank you. And I'm hoping that the whole board has had a chance with the new members to discuss this as well. That's my assumption. And so certainly like here from Mr. Vick as well. So I see paragraph 2 that you have here in red. Is the complaint process maybe we're missing the T there. I'm just thinking of how the sufficiency hearing goes. And really, if it's the complainant who is saying the confidential information in that instance would be. So if the complaint is saying there's a violation here because confidential information was given, and so but that won't be further disclosed according to this paragraph, just the general topic. How then would could sufficiency be determined? You don't have full details of the complaint.
Okay, that is also going to be in the implementing portion there. And on the very end of my read ahead, I have identified the procedures that the board is considering that is not going to disadvantage either party.
Now, because we have a number of attachments here.
The implementing procedures are the detailed admin procedures of how we do these hearings, and the board has control on the sufficiency hearing. Now, the public official could be the complainant, and it could be the defendant. And we know it is going to be the defendant. And we have to ask at the very, very beginning if there's going to be any confidential information contained in this complaint. And we're depending on the disclosure on this one, since we're not privy to that information. But if there is, and we think it is pertinent, and we need to know exactly what that information is, we have in our in the code that the person involved can say, I want my hearing in public or in private. Okay, if he has it in public, we're not going to mention one thing, only the title of that confidential information. But to give us the information we need to glean the truth of the allegation is that we propose to do an executive session with public officials only. The board members are public officials. The attorney assigned, our legal counsel, is our legal counsel. We are their clients, so they are prohibited from repeating anything else outside of the executive session. And in this one, we do not consider this would be a disadvantage to either one of the parties if we have a heads up on what exactly they are allegating, and also that we will only repeat the title of that confidential information.
Okay. The history behind some of this, what it was referred to, was to close the loophole, essentially, that we found. Knowing that a public official, for example, shares confidential information in the executive session, the only way you know that really is if another council member, another person who was involved, knew that happened. Mm-hmm. Just bringing that forward, just making, you know, you got to fill out a form to file an ethics complaint against somebody, and you got to put something on there, and that's a public record. Mm-hmm. There's also, whoever's being accused also has the right to have an open or a closed session.
Yes.
And so I don't think that was addressed based on what you said, because what you're talking about more is just they have a right to do it, but what if they choose to have open, what if someone would say, you know, I want an open hearing, which is their right to do so according to the code, and yet it's about information that's executive session or confidential information, so that I don't know that that's been solved by what you've said so far. So
basically, all of the sections that deal with confidential information, there's two of them contained in the code, is the definitions and then the discussions on prohibited disclosure of confidential information. That brings forward, even when we're doing the hearings on this one, and even if there is a hearing examiner, they would abide by that, our code here. But basically, if they have it, it's, you know, they have an official complaint. You will have to go with what effect that had on, that caused the complaint against the public official. But we will not disclose the contents of the confidential information only to public officials. And that means if it's in an open or a closed session, if the complainant is not a public official, we will not disclose the contents of that. We're prohibited from doing that.
The complainant is the person who's bringing the charges of whatever it is.
Yes.
Don't I mean, they have, they're, we've specifically added language in the past to make sure that that person gets to stay involved through the process, needs to be involved through the process, you know, to not have just frivolous, you know, throw something and then, you know, and then run away. I mean, the complaint needs to see it get through, you know, that type of thing. So you're saying that they would be excluded. If it was not a public official, that person would make a complaint but then wouldn't be able to participate.
They will be able to participate. And basically, they're not, if the complainant, let's say, for example, the complainant is not a public official, it's a citizen. There's nothing to prohibit for them saying all over the place about the contents of the confidential information. We would not allow it in the hearing because basically we're bound. The public official concerned is also bound. It will not be disclosed on the content. And we needed to know exactly what's happened. If you disclose confidential information, there's a cause and effect. What effect did this have? That is what you're going to be charged with on that. And it had to do with the fact that it was disclosed to some unknown person outside of the selected audience.
So the introduction of having an executive session is really the change.
It's that.
I'm trying to marry that with.
It is. It emphasizes do not disclose confidential information. That applies from the minute you start in on any of the hearings on this. And since these are all public officials, board members, they can't disclose it if they know anything about it. They're prohibited from disclosing the contents of any of that. But you have to also verify. Somebody can say, okay, this is confidential. I need another source also that says, okay, this is exactly how it is confidential. So when I say it's pertinent to doing the hearing, but it is only in detail that you will do it with public officials.
Okay, and I appreciate that the things that you said are not clear based on what I'm reading here.
No, in the code, you don't want to mess too much up with admin information there. You want to put straight.
There needs to be a process that everybody understands.
And then the supplement to this is our procedural rules. On that particular document, it can go into excruciating detail if it's needed on exactly what step 1, 2, and 3 on processing anything that has to do with this confidential information being non-disclosed.
My ultimate goal, and the goal when we referred this, was to close a loophole. You couldn't bring; it would be very hard to bring a complaint against an official sharing executive session data, because by doing that you would be revealing the data yourself, closing that. And so the ultimate thing I'm trying to get to is how is that fixed by what we see.
And basically,
and it sounds like having an executive session within the sufficiency hearing is how that would be accomplished.
And that's what I'm saying. As it is needed, this is one that you based on past experience or just knowing how to process it. If you think anything is pertinent and it is classified as confidential, then immediately that goes into an executive session with only public officials that will go in detail on disclosing what the contents of that confidential information is. We will not be discussing it anywhere outside. You have no control on a complainant that is not a public official.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Councilor Williams.
Thank you. I guess I have a concern on the executive session where we talk about conflict of interest in here, but it's not really related to executive session. And one of the concerns that I have is that during meetings, we'll have people get up and leave because they have, there's bills that we're going to be signing off on the consent agenda, and one of the 1,000 of them happens to be a company that somebody works for. And so they have to get up and leave the meeting. And we're constantly refusing ourselves because of conflict of interest, which, very large degrees. The biggest concern I have, though, is we don't have anything specifically talking about that during executive session. And, you know, just in recent history, we've had people sitting up here whose friends were suing the city, and they're meeting in executive session to discuss that lawsuit. That's happened on a couple occasions. And I know, as a new council member, there were times a few years ago when I felt, boy, it just seems like this person shouldn't be in this executive session. But you feel kind of odd as a brand new council member to tell somebody that you should get on the meeting because it doesn't look fair. And I have a concern that that's kind of, you know, that whole process is ignored in this document. And I would like to see something, if we're going to go down this road of closing this loop, I would like to see some stronger language, specifically talking about things that are conflict of interest for executive sessions.
When you're talking of trying to get very, very specific, it's very difficult to put it in a cookbook fashion to make out, okay, this and this and this is confidential. It is based upon the guidelines that are presented in the code that will have a beneficial interest to that individual involved. A lot of times, what we're depending upon is the integrity of that public official to disclose, hey, I may have a conflict of interest. It's better to, on the side of caution, to disclose it, and then during the meeting on wherever it's conducted, that they decide on whether they need to be in there or not. But we are, we have no other choice but to have the integrity of the public officials come up forth and say when anything is a conflict.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you can't detail everything out, but, you know, there's a section on conflict of interest, there's a section on executive session or confidential information, but there's nothing in this move that puts strong language saying that that should even be more so honored during executive sessions. And so, you know, that, again, my concern, and I've stated this before, it's not news to most people, is that it seems like this ordinance has a lot of holes and there's a lot of vagueness and ambiguity, and we spend a lot of time trying to piece it together and fix it, and at the end of 2.5 years, I don't know that we've gotten any further than we were before I started. And if we can't close some of these loopholes and do something that prevents, you know, to me it's much more important if we have somebody sitting and talking about legal strategy or pricing of property if they have a conflict of interest than when we're talking about recusing ourselves because I work for Lowe's and somebody bought a screwdriver from Lowe's. And that's the problem I have. And, you know, I don't know if we're probably not going to solve that tonight, but...
Yeah, and some of this one, you know, it may be, and that's what I'm saying, it depends, because you can't do it very, very specific and in very structured fashion when you're dealing with the code of conduct on these. There's a lot of language that's all boilerplate, but it depends on the situation as it arises and in the information that's being disclosed and conducted. But that individual, they know that basically you have all of these guidelines that tell you that, okay, you're going, in your public official position, you're going to have some economical benefit. Your family, and the family that is described into the definition code, they're going to have an economic benefit from my participating in this because I've got advanced knowledge. It's like treating a commercial firm and their trade secrets or their pricing strategy. You have to have the knowledge to be able to say, okay, this is what you need to be careful. If you think a person needs to be recused, just ask them. And that's what the legal counsel is there for. They will tell you for a fact on whether how strong that is or whether, you know, that's just a minute interest that would not affect it. But if there's anything else particular there, yes, we could work on. this is just bringing it forward to be emphasized. And you just, there's no substitute for understanding on how the ethics codes work. And we found that it does work. We found a few items that were a little out of line. But for the most part, it has worked.
That's very good.
Thanks. I'm going to say that I think there's probably some debate there as to whether or not this ordinance has worked. I think there, unfortunately, there's a political history behind it that is like the elephant in the room. And so closing some of these loopholes, the intent behind that is to make it a document that is more fair than, in my opinion, in the way that it was initially drafted for the purposes for which it was initially drafted. But nonetheless, I agree with Councilmember Williams. The even something that says, we would ask that some text of some sort could be come up with to address the scenario that he described. I don't know how you would do that. I'm just trying to think of some of a paragraph that we could add that would reference something that everybody can see. But you know, how do you ask that person to leave when everybody can see it? But that person doesn't necessarily have to leave. I don't know that you can't necessarily force someone to leave, even though they probably should, but they don't. Is there a way to deal with that? And so, I would look for discussion from the board with perhaps a solution for that. Maybe there isn't one, but I think that's what you're getting to is it's pretty obvious to everyone that person X, really shouldn't be in the room, but doesn't have to leave because it's not really illegal. But it's an appearance of fairness where, let's say, others can see it, but that person refuses to leave. Really, is that up to them? Probably is, but is there some sort of text you can add to give a little more teeth to that with regard to that?
I can research to see on the question, what you're saying, the questionable attendance of somebody that may have a small conflict of
interest. Not just small, any.
Any.
The scenario that was described earlier by Councilmember Williams is what I'm talking about. So, there's probably a laundry list of things we could go through. But the purpose of the meeting is to be able to, for you guys to be able to go back and do some of those things as well. Right?
Okay, so, more or less to when a conflict of interest exists.
There's not specific legal. If the attorney's going to say, I don't know. Maybe there isn't.
I've worked with several of the ethics code all the way up, and basically the best thing that they had come up with, rather than coming down to a cookbook because you can't say, okay, it's training sessions. This here is considered what it may be a conflict of interest when you're doing these certain things, and you may not even think about it. And that supplements on being an ethical public official on there. And that is, I'll have to research to see if I can find anything else that even comes out and lays out any more teeth to that one. It's like many of the codes, you can't be so precise that it boxes you in. And then it's just being so stringent that it doesn't work. But when you're in this executive session where you're saying that maybe you think this other person should not be, they cannot release any of the information whatsoever. What goes on there stays there.
Well, we hope so. But that's part of the loophole that we have is that sometimes it doesn't. And how do we deal with that, which is the original question of that's the circle that we're in there.
And what happens there is if they have come across, somebody's going to pick up the information. Now, somebody may eat whatever the allegation is on the complaint. Who knows? They've got a far field on this one. But whatever the allegation is, it's the effect of them having access to that confidential information that it was not placed in the public domain. Nobody else knew about it. Economical? that's really what the allegations come down to, because they said, okay, they benefited by having this one. You can call it inside trading or anything that you like, but no, in the public domain did not have the information, economical benefit to that family and their circle members there.
Just sharing it in and of itself is a violation. I don't, there doesn't have to be economic benefit for if you're spilling an executive session data.
But they wouldn't get a complaint on that one unless it kind of flows into that one, because if they said, oh, well, they released public information here, and then they would have to basically come back and what the allegation would be. Now, this is real life. That if they have that economical benefit went to the some individual there that has that's a public official, and that is what they complain about. Whether the allegation proves true or not, that's what we have to determine on that. But I can research and see if they, I can find anything else that has too much any more teeth when it goes into disclosing and recusing an individual that that may be involved in any type of conflict of interest on whatever business is taking place. And I'm not sure that I can come up with too much, because it is a vague field, and it depends what's the circumstances. But I will get back with you on that one.
Councilmember Williams.
Thank you. I just want to reiterate, I don't know the language to tell you to put in here. To me, it's a problem that I know that if I work for Lowe's and the city bought a screwdriver from them, I should get up and recuse myself. But I don't know from reading the ethics ordinance that if I'm a member of the union that's collectively bargaining with the city, that I recuse myself from executive session. Or if my friend is suing the city, that I get up and recuse myself. And because there's nothing in here about that, there, you know, we have things, we have words such as public officials and city employees may accept de minimis gifts such as but not limited to calendars, coffee mugs, flowers, candy, and other similar items. So we've taken the time to put, you know, things like that that kind of explain intent in there. But when it comes to executive session, it's completely ignored, and that's my concern. I just think it's not the responsibility of a brand new council member to tell the mayor or another council member you should get up and leave during executive session, and then that person saying, "Well, show me in our ethics ordinance where it says anything to do with this." So I don't know the right language to say this should go in there. That's the problem that I see that I'd like to see solved.
Now, there is some vagueness that it comes with the territory on that one. Let me check and see if I can find anything else in any of the other ethic codes that come around that it will even come back and address exactly putting more teeth in there on giving them a guide. It'll have to be guidelines. It probably won't be very specific on there. It could only kind of come down to guidelines on that. Gives you the flexibility to move on.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if there's consensus up here. I personally feel that you could put a strict guideline that says that if you're a member of a bargaining unit that's bargaining with the city, that's a complete conflict of interest. You know, so that's something that I think could be in there very specifically, because that has to deal with you negotiating on both sides of the table. And, you know, that is something that we're presented with as an option, as a possibility all the time up here. So, you know, there's one example where I think we could be very specific.
Councilmember Hamper.
As a new council member, to be quite frank, this whole, the whole ethics concerns and everything has been quite muddy, and been, just to echo Councilmember Williams' comments, been extremely frustrating to have to excuse, most everyone here has excused themselves over, in my eyes, frivolous things. There's no reason for it at all. But out of abundance of caution, we're stepping out to pay a bill that we owe the city owes anyway. So regardless of who works for who, it's not affecting anything. And to me, it seems very vague and excessive. And I don't know if this is, you know, the time to cover all that, but just to concur with Councilmember Williams and hearing, it's been extremely frustrating and would definitely, I think we would benefit by having some clear-cut guidelines, as was just suggested, trying to eliminate some of the vagueness so that we're not, as we go through our agenda on a weekly basis, we're not scouring for anything that we could possibly be, you know, prosecuted against or complained against because of frivolous reasons.
Has that ever prevented you from doing your business, of not having enough members present to do voting?
Yes.
Yes, it has.
Okay. Isn't there a state code that governs that? I have to refer. We do not have a legal counsel, and I'll have to refer this one to your city council here.
City attorney.
I think there is something that, if I remember in the past, there's a city code, I mean a state code, that allows people that need to be recused, that they may participate whenever it involves that you need to quorum to do an official action.
That's correct, Mr. Mayor. It's known as the doctrine of necessity. It's expressly codified and most commonly used in the context of an appearance of fairness challenge or appearance of fairness matter, which in turn is limited mainly to quasi-judicial action, so it has very limited applicability. And to follow on Councilmember Hanford and Councilmember Williams' comments, I've discussed these issues in the code about the ambiguity that exists in Chapter 2.52. That can be construed, some of the language, as requiring recusal in situations where clearly under the state law it would not be. And I think that there are a few very easy fixes there that I'd be very happy to work with staff or the ethics board to recommend. Very minor clarifying changes that really wouldn't, I don't think, change the underlying intent of the document. But I think those are very simple, very easy changes.
Now, that would be something that we have to depend on a legal counsel to provide to us whenever it pulls down that state code on there. And this is where we have used to have the benefit of having one, and we could give that to you at the moment, since the recommendations fall within the authority of the council. I'll have to defer to the city council if they could if they can put a few of those tweaks in there that will allow you to do your business even when there's a slight conflict there. But I can also check and see if I can find anything else in any of the ethics codes or instructions that would deal with it that would also help it as far as guidelines.
Councilmember Hampton?
Yeah, I would definitely be interested in seeing what we can do to clarify things, and as well to, I guess I feel like as a new council member, if we can go along with my correlation here, I'm the second child, second born child, and the first born child took out the car and smashed it and ruined it. And now I'm turning 16 and I want to go drive with Dad saying no, because the firstborn smashed the car, so now we're not going to drive anymore. Or there's going to be major stipulations on when you're going to drive and how. And that's kind of how I feel. So I'd love to have some kind of clarification so that I don't feel that way.
scenes, we'll have City Attorney Lell draft some of that language as he's shared and provide that to the ethics board for them to include as part of the changes or the direction that council is looking for here tonight with regards to that conflict of interest related to confidential information. Councilmember Williams.
Thank you. Just to clarify, was the city attorney going to help draft some language that can fix the gaps that you're talking about?
My comments, Council, were specifically geared toward addressing the perceived concern about the ethics code that was being over-applied and that the council was being forced into a position having to accuse yourselves where that really wasn't the intent of the code. For any use, the extreme example of buying a screwdriver at Lowe's, and Councilor Hansford used the example of having to pour through the agenda line by line. I think that in my review of the ethics code, the concern there is the potential ambiguity and disconnect between two subsections of the code, section 252.040B. It's requirement that public officials not take part in any council action concerning any contract, property, or other matter of any kind in which the public official or his immediate family has a financial interest. That on one hand, and then the definition of financial interest in MMC 2.52.20H, which is extremely broad and at least with respect to contracts, suggests that you have a financial interest if you have any form of any ownership interest in any business entity in an amount or value greater than 1%, et cetera. I think that casts an extremely broad net, and I think is the root cause of some of the concerns that have arisen as well. I've been city attorney, and that extreme construction of that very broad construction of those two subsections, I don't believe is required by state law. So the question that you have as a city council is whether you would like to have that extremely broad interpretation apply at the local level through your ethics code. I don't, think that there's any requirement to that effect at the state level. And in its most extreme example, it could be construed as meaning that since each of you has an interest financially or ownership-wise in your own real property, that you could never vote on the city's annual tax levy. Honestly, you laugh, but that's
frustrating.
And clearly that's not contemplated by the state law. The financial interest conflict provisions that exist under the state ethics code are specific to contract interest. And that, I think, makes a lot of sense, and that's what the entire state law ethics code is built around. I think that there's been some, unfortunately, vague, ambiguous text in the city's local code that has the potential to give an overly expansive interpretation. So again, it's a policy question for the council of which direction you'd like to go, but I can provide some suggested clarifying text if that's your preference.
If I still have the floor, that would be my preference, because all along it seems like we do a good job of preventing a city employee from getting a $5 gift card to Starbucks. We, on the other hand, do a very vague job of protecting what, in my opinion, is really important, you know, executive session information. And throughout the document, we always refer to it as a financial interest, and not everything is a financial interest. That some of you might have a personal interest that far supersedes any financial interest. I could sit up here and make a decision because it helps my brother, but I don't have a financial interest in that. So that's the kind of vagueness that concerns me. And, you know, to elaborate on what Councilmember Gearing was talking about, that, you know, in the past, it was before any of our times, but it seems like this has been used as a weapon in times past. And it shouldn't be that. It should be a guideline, and it should be something that everybody can look at and follow and not have to worry that if someone disagrees with them on an issue, they're going to go try to find a loophole in this and use that against them. You know, that's the concern. So if I would be in favor of what you suggested, if we could kind of clean up the real low priority stuff and tighten up some of the important stuff. To me, that's much more important, and I would feel much better about the ordinance if it did that.
Councilmember Gary.
Thank you. And if that meant an entire rewrite, I'd be in favor of that, too. I think there might be benefit to removing the creation of the Ethics Board from the ordinance so that the board can stand on its own, and that the ordinance itself can then be changed as needed without affecting the board, so that the board can weigh in. Again, an idea, but something that separates the definitions and whatnot from the actual existence of a board. I think it's very valuable to have an Ethics Board. It serves a good purpose, but I think their task is even more difficult given the document that that we have here to work with. And I think it can be simplified and still be as effective, and actually be stronger with the removal of these, the closing of the loopholes. So as much work as necessary that might need to be done to do that, I'm all in favor of. Thank you.
Okay, now what did you want the Ethics Board to do any other work on this one, or did you want your city attorney to put in those tweaks and some of the rewrites and so forth to match what you desire before you come back, or is there any task that you want us to do?
If you're asking me, I would certainly like the attorney to provide some fixes. Absolutely. But then, obviously, we give this to you for your recommendations as the way that you see it. And certainly, hopefully, look forward to hearing from everybody, the next time, hopefully, more folks can come. But, like I said, that there's as Councilman Williams said, there's the big stuff and there's the little tiny stuff. And my concern is the big stuff. And so, however we need to do that, I think we've already asked you guys to look at the loophole, and based on that, here's what we have back. Now let's make some wording changes based on those. So again, I appreciate the time you guys have put in to look at this and what you've given us back. Thank you.
So you do want us to also check to see if there's any other guidelines that we want while your city attorney is doing the tweaks to this?
I think what I heard is having the city attorney bring forth some legal recommendations, submit those to the Ethics Board, and the Ethics Board would then return to the City Council with recommendations along with their own. So the first step, I think, would be to have the attorney provide some legal definitions and legal input, submit that to the Ethics Board for review and additional input, and return to Council with that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, I think what we're talking about, though, is that's cleaning up the two sections that you specifically talked about, that it doesn't involve any cleanup of the matter, but it's to strengthen executive session conflict of interest. Is that?
That was my understanding. My understanding was that Chairman Williams was going to take the lead on the larger project, and then the direction to me is just to bring back what I perceive to be a fairly minor language correction to add some clarification regarding when council members need to recuse themselves from voting on matters concerning property that they may have an interest in. Is that Mr. Mayor's understanding as well?
Okay, then. So that we're actually having parallel objectives here, one by the city attorney, one by the Ethics Board. The Ethics Board is being asked to look at stronger language regarding executive session information, and I, from what it sounded like to me is whether or not is the council seeking the ability to either ask a council member to recuse themselves from the executive session or expect a council member to recuse themselves if the perceived conflict is is evident. Is that where you were heading, Councilmember Williams?
Well, like I said, I haven't studied this enough. I don't have the answer. I just know that the examples we gave. There's a bill for a screwdriver. I know I got to get them to leave. But some of this other stuff is much more serious. There's nothing in there. So that's the only thing I'm trying to solve. And just from personal experience, it did happen as a brand new council member where I felt somebody should have recused themselves. But, you know, in your first or second or third week, you don't feel comfortable doing that. You also don't know this document that well either. So I just think that the absence of any examples, you know, kind of makes that more vague. You know, we give examples of what de minimis gifts are, such as calendars, coffee mugs, flowers, candy, but nothing for executive session. So just three or four examples so that there's something to tie, you know, something to hold somebody accountable to.
Together and see what we come up with on the examples that would not interfere with some of the tweaks that he does that pulls the state code and get that down so you can operate. Okay, the next recommended change has to do with identifying the administrative error in posting on our conflict of interest at 0.0440. And this section...
Which attachment is this? There's a number of attachments. So make sure I'm on the right one.
Yes, B1.
Attachment B. Oh, I thought we were passing.
Yes.
B1. Thank you.
Okay. Now, I used official records on this, which is the ordinance, to come down through here because there's always been an ambiguity noticed in this particular section. There's seven paragraphs to it. What we used as a baseline was Ordinance 025 of 2003, which was effective in December of 2003. And whenever they posted the changes thereafter, there was a repeal of a section. They dropped that particular paragraph and renumbered the remaining paragraph. This is what caused all of the problems because we'd like to reinstate that one dropped paragraph. And what that is, the paragraph is that we've identified before. It just says that you won't seek or ask for a more favorable condition if it's not available to the general public. In other words, don't use your position to gain advantages that nobody else has on there. And the exact wording comes from the original code that's identified there.
I personally think that was taken out for a reason. It's essentially unenforceable. And for that reason, I don't know what other problems that's caused. It's to say that that's caused all the problems, I'm not sure what problems you're talking about there, because haven't had that many actual complaints over the course of the history of the document. So to say that it was taken out for a reason.
This is the administrative error. They repealed paragraph E. It was redundant. Okay. Then when they posted, they dropped it completely and renumbered. There is no ordinance that gave them that instruction. So basically what they did is they came back in and repealed the new paragraph E. And if you look at the attachment, you can see where it is posted. If you look at B3, and you come down through here, I'll go through it. It recaptures the changes by two ordinances in 2004. The first one that they did, the ordinance on 02 of 2004, added paragraph G that gave them the permission to have a beneficial interest in a contract if it was a public official or a city employee, if these particular circumstances were met. Okay, that was the very last paragraph. And September of 2004, there was a citizens initiative that came back in, verified, audited, and accepted by the council, and they went and they issued ordinance number 026 of 2004, effective September 2004. It overrode the information and amended paragraph C. They overrode and replaced paragraph D with the citizens' initiative. And on that particular ordinance, they repealed paragraph E, a redundant one. When they reposted after this one and republished the information, they eliminated the new E because they renumbered F to E, read E, and G to read F. It's messed up. And it's administrative error. There was no ill intent involved in this one. We just want to put that one particular paragraph in, identify E as repealed, reinstate paragraph F, and as a result of all of these changes, supersede and repeal the very last paragraph G. And the reason for repealing that is that it is a conflict with the citizens' initiative. That citizens' initiative is fenced by from the citizens, and it cannot be changed unless it's by the citizens on there. By the very language on there, it says you shall not. Authoritative language, it says you will not be awarded contracts. The very last paragraph, which is referencing an obsolete paragraph D, says notwithstanding B, you may if you meet these conditions. This is a direct conflict and by operation of that citizens initiative with the language there. It will be superseded if it is conflicting. So best just to get rid of it.
You guys clear it? I'm a little
yes, it no. Gets confusing.
No, it is.
Also, if you would look at B4, and what you're going to see down here is a complete posting on this one. And what it shows here, C, on when it was put in there, the second C is when it was amended and replaced. Current information. Paragraph D.
You're on
attachment
B4. B4. Section.
.040.
What I have here is B4252.0.040. And you're talking about?
This is the posting of your ordinances through 2004 and how it was an administrative error whenever they went in there and did the posting and the repealing. The new paragraph D there is the citizen initiative, completely fenced. The one with the authoritative language of no contracts to city, members of the City of Monroe Board, unless it was under the rule covered by the CPAs and so forth.
Councilmember Williams.
Personally, I would not be in favor of doing this change without some more information to see kind of the history or the red line versions of this. I'm not following it very well, and I'm sure other people are not either. My recommendation would be table it and get maybe some more information. My experience with this ordinance started when I was running for office, and there were three or four meetings, people going over line by line of the ordinance. I never heard that, so that group prior to me coming on didn't know about this change. We've talked about it several times since then. So I don't know if that's the correct information that was held out because of administrative error or something else. I would just like to see something a little easier to follow personally before I said I'm in favor of making this change.
No, it was very difficult. That's why I had to post most of these down through here and tell you what had happened to them as they went along. 2004 is the year that you had last paragraph added that gave permission to have contracts awarded to city officials and public officials. That was March of 2004. In September of 2004, effective date, Ordinance 026 of 2004 was a citizens' initiative. That was the one that came in there. And there was three changes on that ordinance. They rewrote paragraph C. And I will give you a red line on that one. And the baseline from the posting will be from December of 2003 when it comes forward, because that's where the administrative error occurred. The only new action that we're recommending is because the language in the Citizens Initiative conflicts with that one paragraph that gave permission, which they said they may have contracts, but they meet these exceptions. That is straight out conflict, and by operation of the language in the Citizens Initiative, that it is superseded. In other words, it's overrode, and that makes it redundant, and that last paragraph should be just outright repealed. But I will give you a redline version from those changes and what was followed. I'll give you an index of the ordinance, and we zeroed in on the ones that affected the ethics code on the ordinances written. And it tells you exactly the number, the effective date, and the purpose of why they were issued on there. But it was posted to the ethics code. I'm only, the ones that you would be concerned with is on the conflict of interest. And if you post it exactly as they come forth, you will see where the errors occurred in there. It was never an intentional on that one. It just removed a normal boilerplate on a code of ethics. That's it.
With all due respect, there's nothing normal or boilerplate about a code of ethics. It's a standalone that no other city that I know of does. So you're kind of blazing the trail.
Indeed.
And I would just like maybe if staff could look into that and give us a recommendation, then I think we can move on, and that would make me feel like I have enough information.
That's what I was going to
I will redline that one and so that it shows how it's done, and I will give you an index of the ordinances and the purpose on there so you can follow down on exactly how they were done. And if you post it exactly, that's what comes back. When I say a normal boilerplate for the Code of Ethics, it's one of the standards they put in just about every ethics regulation around. That you're not going to use your position for any favored benefit on there. And it's not anything that is new or outstanding. it was there at the original, and it was just dropped because they repealed it again, and they got the wrong one. And it is, it's very difficult to go down there and try to determine what's going to happen on there. But when I did that one, there was just two actions that came in on that one. Like I said, a reinstatement and repeal.
Chairman Williams, if you would, how about if we have you submit the red line version to Edie?
Yeah.
And Edie will have our city attorney review to see what challenges might exist currently, if any, and then make recommendations as to possible corrections to that section based on.
Okay, basically, if you'd like, now this is the abstract of the ordinances that were submitted, and it's focused in on the ethics. And this is exactly the verbiage that came off of the ordinance. You can read it from official records. Now, I did not take anything else but the official records before I went down because it was so confusing. I said, how did they get there whenever it should never even, it never had anything to do with contracts. And I said, something does not read correctly. And it was identified in our board members real early on, and I think later on, but it never got to the point that we could really present it to you, because it will cause a problem if you misconstrue what is written in these. And with one conflicting with the other one, and that last paragraph referring to a paragraph, the verbiage no longer exists. It refers to that citizen's initiative.
Okay. We'll have the city attorney review that process and review the sections that you pointed out here and bring back a recommendation to both the Ethics Board and to City Council. Councilmember Campbell?
Thank you. I just want to reinforce the red line version and the history. I didn't know.
I will have Edie pass that out. I just gave it to him as a heads up on that one, but Edie's got that one too, so that it gives everybody an idea on exactly what we were talking about. You go into the original ordinance and you read down there exactly what it did. I would have done the red line on there, but whenever I get one of those copies, I have a protected document. And I have to go back to the 2003 version of this one. So basically, it's just more or less, I'll have to reproduce that one to get a red line. And that was the reason why you do not get that red line version. That would have been much easier than trying to tell you at the top on what ordinance came here and this one here. And we changed, sometimes you change the wording of a paragraph, and the other ones you would replace it entirely. And so that was the difficult portion on there.
Okay, one more. I just want to make sure I understand the two areas that we're discussing are of concern. Because I'm looking at the current ordinance of paragraph D, members of the city of Monroe, boards and commissions, etc., are prohibited from making work contracts versus E, which is notwithstanding subsection D, that they may have a beneficial interest. These are the two sections.
Those are the last one on there.
Right.
Yes. The one that is now reading paragraph, I think, F on the 2000.
Right, that's where I started getting confused. Okay. I just want to make sure this is the area that we're targeting.
Yes. And then you're missing one paragraph in there.
Okay, and that's what we'll look at for red line.
And that one that I would have to go back in there and where the exact verbiage on there, and it shows how those two paragraphs and why they dropped the first repeal one, renumbered, and then they repealed it again. They got the wrong one.
I look forward to seeing the answer. Thank you.
Yeah. I said those things happen when you're posting.
Councilmember Hampton.
I guess since Chairman Williams will be bringing that back, is there anything else that we need to do to motion to be made to close the discussion period?
No. I think we have some good direction,
okay.
and And with that, I think we'd probably be appropriate to move on to the remainder of the agenda this evening. But any closing comments here or statements to the ethics board members that are here today?
But Brian, I appreciate your service.
Yeah,
and I know you're a newbie, and I know the other newer members aren't here as well. But I do appreciate the time that you're putting in on the board. So thanks for your service to the community in that way.
Thank you very much for your attention. I had just one other item that goes outside of our area of responsibility, but it goes into the cities on there under your processing the complaints. And this one I'm really addressing to your city attorney, because basically this is where his area of expertise comes in. But under B13, it just says the complaint, determination of sufficiency or no sufficiency, and the written report of the board or the hearing examiners shall be considered public record. Now, the only thing I'm concerned about is whenever you get a public records request, it goes to the city, and if there is confidential information in the complaint form itself. There's personal information which that complaint form should be subject to the Privacy Acts of 1974 and thereafter or forever. But it's silent on that one. Our determinations, whether it's of sufficiency or of a hearing, they're standalone documents. They only recapture the information that we glean to make our determination. Our legal advisor applies the application of law and prepares the document, and we submit it to the city council for their action on there. So our determinations do not have any personal information included. They definitely are redacted. I can't speak exactly for a hearing examiner, but since it is in the same vein as your legal advisor, I would assume that they would follow a format very similar to that. There's no format specified but on that one. And all I ask is that it be subject to the Privacy Acts on that one, so that you can catch and redact that private information, especially contained in the complaint form.
I'll be happy to look into that, Mr. Mayor. And just to reiterate a point that I hope is fairly obvious, the State Public Records Act dictates what is and what will be and must be kept in public release format and subject to public disclosure upon request. And unless there's a specific statutory exemption that carves out a particular area of information that is exempt from that, a general mandate, the city doesn't have the authority at the local level to change that rule. But I'll be happy to work with the ethics board to clarify what for.
Yeah, and this is under .080, big B, paragraph 13, and that was the exact wording on it. It's just that it states it shall be considered public record, and we wanted to make sure we know what our determinations look like. We have control when we submit that. Your actions as a result are no actions whatsoever. There's generally nothing classified in that one, but the complaint form definitely was the area of question on there.
All right.
Thank you very much. I think we already discussed the last one that I had that had to do with an executive session inside of a closed hearing and so forth on that one. And that just brings forth some of the concerns that we had and the legality of those to make sure that we were on sure footing on that one. But I want to thank each one of the board members for listening to us and for all your support and giving us our appointing the rest of our board members so that we can act. And that concludes my discussions.
All right.
thank you.
Yes, you know, thank you very much. And we'll be hearing from you again here. We'll be sure to coordinate that through Edie. Certainly the attorney will have some information back to you in, I don't want to say in rushed order, but short order, and then again we'll coordinate a time to reconvene and have further discussion on the items.
And I will try to get that red line version one way or the other to show the red line through there to Edie as soon as possible so that he can follow on there. The abstract on those ordinances helped tremendously. That's kind of my guideline on the following through there. But those are the only documents used whenever I discuss those.
Okay. Well, thank you. Brian, do you have anything to add here tonight?
I'm just getting up to speed with everything on the ethics board and look forward to working with the team.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.
City Administrator Raswell. I turn this over to somebody, but we have a discussion this evening on a focus for a proposal for an ice arena.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. This is, in my assessment, a very exciting proposal that's been brought forward to Monroe. We have an interested group led up by Mr. Clayton Stewart that's in the office of our audience this evening. Came to staff recently with a proposal to put in an ice arena. This would be located to the west of Fryman's Boulevard, just south of Highway 2 at the existing Monroe Block or Monroe Materials location where they build different same block for projects and home depot and things like that. So anyway, the owners of that property, the subject property, are here as well in the audience this evening, Tom and Brian. And I'm going to turn it over to staff to talk about this particular project. And then if council has any questions, we'll entertain those as well.
Brad or Paul? Or...
Clayton.
All right.
Would you guys like
a
new address?
Clayton Stewart?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome, and if you would, your name and address for the record.
I'm Clayton Stewart. I live at 14722 61st Street in Lake Stevens. Hello, I didn't inform you about this. I'd like to thank you guys for this opportunity to present this, both Mr. Mayor and the council. I think the basics of the project are pretty simplistic. Our goal is to bring a full-service ice arena to the existing Eastside Masonry property. I think the benefits to this community are very numerous. We would have a strong youth hockey program. We have expressions of interest from existing local programs that they would be interested in joining with us. We have the same expressions from an adult recreational league, which is one of the eight largest in the country. It would be considerably dressing up our entrance to town. No offense to Tom and Brian, but I think a new facility at that location would be a great gateway to the city. There are a few challenges. We had hoped to hear from the airport folks as well, but there are a few challenges involved with the airport overlay. Some things that may be able to be worked through with staff and with the airport themselves. Right now we are working on some site design stuff and trying to move forward as quickly as possible as we can with the financing and some of those questions will hopefully be addressed sooner rather than later through working with staff and council and Mr. Editor and his group as well. So with that, I'd like to offer up any questions and see what I can answer for you guys.
With regards to challenges that Clayton has, Mr. Stewart has mentioned here today, Mr. Feilberg has some recommendations or far, Mr. Popelka's got some recommendations, or at least recommended action and direction that he would like to gain approval from the council to pursue. But any questions for Mr. Stewart? Councilmember Gearing?
Thanks. I think it's a very exciting proposal. Really cool. The benefits of what that could bring would be outstanding for the city. So from that aspect, I'm very excited about it. Certainly want to protect the airport as well, so looking for the recommendations on how to marry that, but I'm sure that we'll be able to come up with something that where those two can coexist peacefully. So and certainly I want to say, I guess in advance, yeah, I want to say welcome because I want you guys to be here.
Thank you.
But it's an exciting opportunity. It's stuff for youth as well, which is desperately, desperately needed in the town. And from that aspect, is there like I think one of the concerns probably would be height. And when you're talking about height, is there is how tall is a building like that?
Yeah. Well,
you dug into the ground. I mean, you know, maybe that's not the time for the discussion for, but that'll be a question I would have at some point.
Yeah, I think it's pretty easily answered. In working with our architects, we would be under the 35-foot. Height restriction that's currently in place, and I think that as far as working with the airport, we've had some just informal chats with them, and I don't think it's anything that that we can't work through as a group collectively.
Good. Yeah, and the height of the building would probably be the biggest deal given the zone that it's in and whatnot.
Right.
And so under 35, then. Again, that's another check-in for something that would look good.
Right.
Indeed. Okay, well, that's just exciting idea. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
Councilmember Hammer. Hey, Councilmember Hammer. Let's just go for it.
So yeah, I'm definitely thankful for this idea. Just like what Councilmember Gaines said, definitely look forward to this happening, hopefully that all works out. And something that our youth actually came to me today and said, hey, Bert, about this, is this really going to happen?
Yeah, I think it does have a lot of benefits for, especially for the youth, but as in enhancing Monroe as a recreational destination as a whole, I think that that entire Frylands corridor can be and should be a destination area, and I think this is one more step towards making it just that.
Thank you.
Councilmember Gable.
Yeah, I'm very much interested in staff taking a look at it. I spent a lot of my youth in the Wenatchee Valley, so grew up with youth hockey and figure skating and all the nursery and brought to the valley there, and then I actually grew into two ice rinks. I started with one, but two, and it really gave the a lot for the community to rally behind, and they brought in kids from all the way up from to Chelan and Waterville, Quincy, all over. So yeah, very very interested in seeing how we can deal with some of the issues that are before us and seeing the recommendations on how that, but I'm excited about the potential opportunity. I look forward to seeing proposals. Thank you.
Councilmember Kim.
Thank you. Sounds very exciting. Semi-pro. Like soldiers.
Well, it would probably, the way they break things down, Silvertips are technically called a major junior team. Okay. We would be gunning to host either a Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3 junior team, which is Tier 2 would be similar to Wenatchee Wild.
Okay.
Yep.
Sure.
Tier 3 would be somebody like the Seattle Totems.
Okay.
Tier 1 would be USHL, which includes teams like the U.S. National Development Team Program. And that's actually a very high level of hockey, very similar to the skill level that a Silvertips player would be at. But, all of that is, of course, contingent upon what seating capacities we can determine. So,
that was going to be my next question. Do you have an idea?
Well, a Tier 1 team would most likely require something in the vicinity of, the 3,000-seat arena. For somebody like the Totems,
you could be in the 500 range for a Tier 2 team like the Wild. You could be, you know, in the 1500 to 2000. So that's and the capacity is an issue that would have to be looked at pretty seriously with the group as a whole. But that's definitely one of the goals.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Williams.
Thank you. The information we have says that you're looking for the proposed facility will hold approximately 500 persons.
Yes.
That kind of what you're targeting?
That's kind of the ballpark, although we've had a couple interested investors step forward and say that one of the things that they would like to see and become a part of is that Tier 1 or Tier 2 junior team. So if we can make those kind of modifications and get that kind of seating capacity, then it's something that we would definitely strive for. Otherwise, there is that Tier 3 team that could be made available as well.
Okay. So I'm interested to hear what Paul has to say, but I think the height is not as much the issue as the density, potentially. So I think it's great. I hope everything can work out and we can love sure. Hockey here.
That's where we're here.
I think, yeah, how about the multi-use type stuff? I mean, other ice rinks, we used to play broomball and whatnot, the Highland Ice Arena. And
yes.
Would hope that you would have some sort of a floor that could go in where you could have other events as well.
Yep.
I mean,
absolutely.
There's so many opportunities that could be there, and I'm assuming that's in your plans, but at least I wanted
to. Yeah, I think one of the biggest lifebloods of any recreational facility is its community relations, and there's no better way to build that than through working with groups like the YMCA to have recreational youth skating, open skate, where it's available to any member of the public for a good portion of the time. It helps to have an anchor tenant like a team, but equally important is the community aspect of it and having plenty of open ice available. We would also be open to putting in some side amenities, batting cages, and things that make it a little bit more of multi-use while still being still a fairly single functional facility. So, but broom ball, open skate, curling.
Maybe a Zamboni left. Always wanted to drive a Zamboni.
There you go.
That's every fun.
I'm sorry, that's ethical.
Terrible, terrible.
Anyway, yeah, so I appreciate those.
Sure.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Well, Paul, why don't we hear from you? There's a couple of things, and I think that he has for council and some recommended.
Well, we don't have much to offer right at this point, but our intent tonight was just to get this on the table and introduce it very briefly. I grew up in Minnesota, so I have broom ball and hockey in my blood, and I always want to drive a Zamboni too. We met last week with Clayton and some other folks, and just started looking into what it would take to do this project. There may need to be some revisions to the comp plan. We haven't really determined that yet. If that should ever happen, then the strategy would be this would be a part of the West Monroe land use study, which is on the docket, and that could be completed. I mean, council would be able to, we'd be able to process that and might potentially be able to approve it right after the first of the year. It would have to be next calendar year. Well, I said we haven't determined if that's going to be really that deep of a probe on this. The issue with zoning has to do with basically with like use and density, like you brought up. I put up this aerial just to give some context, but the proposals on the west side of Fryman's and the way these zones are set up is that the property is, Jeff, you got your laser?
Yep, right there.
Right there. Here's the block plant. The property set up in this, falls in this, primarily in this zone 2, and to the west of that is zone 4. So it's in 2 and 4. And there's some potential issues of the permitted use and how it's permitted and one way it is and one way it may not be. But the other issue has to do with density and the density that's allowed in those zones by our current zoning code. 60 per acre average versus 100 per acre average in zone 4. So the density of people could be an issue, but I think there are ways to work through it. But really what we were looking for is kind of an initial reaction, and we need to give some more thought to specifically how to deal with this. One example would be, maybe the use is a conditional use permit or some form of creative mechanisms to help make it happen. So, questions?
Councilor Gary.
Thank you. Paul, what's to prevent us enable us to, let's say, we moved the edge of Zone 2 to be right along Freeland so that the whole thing's in 4? I mean, do we or do we not have the ability to do that so that we'd be able to marry the two where the airport is still protected and, we wouldn't have to worry about any. There are good laws, there are bad laws, and the intent, obviously, is we want to be able to do something fun here that's going to benefit everybody.
Right.
These
are set up.
They're set up to protect the airport, and I understand that.
Right.
I certainly understand that. Moving some lines around, what can we do? So,
These are set up based on WASHDOT guidelines for approachable and so forth. They're not mandates or guidelines. The city, 5 years ago, took those basic guidelines and tailored them somewhat to fit Monroe. So there is a possibility of making some adjustments in those zones. Jeff, do you want to relay your conversation with Daryl?
I spoke with Daryl Hoddick, the owner of First Air. He indicated he feels that the safety zone overlay is an important protection device to the airport as far as uses go. And when I say uses, the worst case scenario would be we have 800 condominiums built around, and those turn into 800 voters, and 800 voters vote in a council that says we are shutting down the airport. That's what this was originally placed there for, is to prevent that type of use encroachment on the airport. However, he did indicate that hockey arena, he doesn't see any conflict whatsoever with the airport, and he would like to sit down with staff and the applicant and see if we could figure out a way to make this a doable project. So I'm speaking based on my conversation with Daryl. He was going to speak tonight. I know he had to leave a little bit early. Probably the most critical aspect is the actual densities within each zone, and that might be the area of the code that you could take a look at, as instead of 60 per acre in zone 2, maybe that number could be changed. But again, it comes back to council discretion and how they want to approach this.
Thank you.
I should explain just quickly that density is based on an average number of people per acre, and what you do is you calculate the occupant load of the building and you divide that by, in this case, 7 acres. So when it's 60 people per acre, there could have theoretically 420 people assembled.
Can I ask a follow-up question about that? I think you said the intent is really about, more like residential, right around the density applies to regardless. It's just people in general, not people living.
It's
in one of these zones. It's literally just bodies that
it's even more
transient. Come in and out.
But single-family residential is allowed in some of the higher zones, including 3 and 4, but at very low density. So it's really about number of heads, people.
Regardless of whether they're full time, regardless of they're living there versus just coming and going. That's where my question.
Living residential is, I guess, one house per 5 acres.
Extremely low.
It's extremely low. You're not living there when you get up to 100 people per acre.
Okay.
Or 60
acres.
And I understand the original reason that was done. I just, we need to relook at that. That's the bottom line.
And so we're looking at,
make sure the airport's viable.
We're looking at different possibilities, both, each way, just to try and see what might come in.
Grocery store, there's lots of things that could or could not happen there. It'd be nice to think about everything that could actually go in there, and if that's going to be an issue, then let's
let's make the numbers right. So, yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, we have some creative thinking to do.
True.
And Mr. Stewart, thank you for coming out tonight. Appreciate having you here and presenting your thoughts to council this evening. And council will, staff will move forward and we'll bring some things back to you at some point. No promises tonight, but we'll be working on this diligently. Thank you. Woods Creek Road multi-purpose trash.
Trail.
It's not that way.
Come on, man.
Wow, I can see. Trail. Multi-purpose.
Not to be biased by the. One of the items on the. Both the six-year transportation improvement program and the list of projects for the transportation benefit district was the Woods Creek Road multi-purpose trail. We applied for grant funding, and we applied for $2.1 million. And were awarded $930,266 of CMAQ funds, which is congestion mitigation and air quality. So the reason we applied for that actually was not building new roads money, it was money to get people off roads so they could walk somewhere. So that's why that lower down on the list, but that's why I qualified for that grant funding. We've really sharpened our pencils and removed some of the facing of the walls required and things like that to cut the price down to $1.5 million. But in order to be awarded the grant, we need to tell them that we will come up with the $600,000 extra that is needed for that, or otherwise they give the money to somebody else. We are applying for other grant funds that would cover that, but we won't know if we get those until the end of the year, and we need to tell them by the end of the month whether or not we will be able to finish the project. So I'm coming to you and saying, gee, you want to kick in $600,000? And you might ask, where would that money come from? Same place that the money to pay for the extra cost of the grants would come from. So, you know, we have a pending sale that you were planning on putting most of that money into reserve funds, and that's basically the only source of money is taking out, instead of putting it into the reserve funds, is to use money for the sale of Galaxy Theater. So we say, yes, we accept it and hope we get grant funding, or we say, no thanks.
Councilor McCann.
Thank you. So, Brad, if we do go forward with this and we don't have the $600,000, we just pay this back?
We don't get the money until you spend it, and if we don't have the money, we're not going to go out to bid for a $1.5 million project with only $930,000. The downside is if we don't tell them in time that we are not. If we say, yes, we've got the money and then decide not to do it, we get a black mark against our name, and so next time they're divvying up money, they're going to go, well, Monroe didn't do it last time, so we'll just skip over them and give it to somebody else, so actually we'll do a project.
Okay, so how is there a time or a final date that we have to show them we're going to come up with $600,000?
We have to show them the final thing. The sooner the better, because once they want it by the end of the month. If we say by the end of the month we'll do it, and based on selling the property Galaxy and using that money, and that sale falls through for some reason, we can still say no. But after the first of the year, it's then this black mark time from us. So,
thank you,
Councilmember Hanford.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand Oak Street. Up to Woods Creek. Can you describe that?
It's basically the driveway to Safeway up to along the left-hand side of Woods Creek Road when you're going out of town until there's that trail that goes up to the farm.
Okay. Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Councilor Gary?
Thanks. I like the idea and concept. I much prefer to pay off debt and to fund our reserve funds with that money. So I'll leave my comments at that.
Councilor Williams?
Brad, how much did you say we applied for the grant?
$2.1 million.
And that the total?
That is the as-designed project right now.
And
it included, we took off the decorative finish of the wall, which cut it by approximately $500,000, so got it down to about $1.5 million.
So, and this is $1.5 million base to build a sidewalk?
To build a sidewalk, yeah, and the retaining wall. Basically, it's because the retaining wall is needed is why it costs so much. Yeah.
And I think when we originally talked about it, the rationale for moving forward was we thought there was grant money out there that would potentially pay for the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it's, to me, it seems like a great deal if it's completely paid for $600,000. So I would have to agree with Councilman Gary that seems like a lot of money that we don't have.
So the alternative here then is to deny or to turn down the grant for this year and reapply in subsequent years.
Yes. If there's money available.
Yeah.
If I can ask a follow-up question, is this that grant only for this project? Or we can't use that?
Yeah, we can't use it for anything else. No. We actually have another application out there that is for design of the trail on Chain Lake Road to extend that past the Country Crescent. That is farther down the list, so basically they take the $930,000 and divvy it up, and we may or may not get to us for that. So depending on what are the projects that are on the list above us.
After some of the land sales and we've paid off, we may be in a better spot right to fund some of this, some of the gap. And so I'd certainly love to consider it in the future. My personal.
So it sounds to me as though not hearing from everybody yet, but no objections means. That's what I'm hearing.
Do we need to make a motion to define a grant?
No, just direct staff to.
Either way, depending on just letting me get several nods or shakes.
So I would say.
So is there a motion?
Thank you.
Second.
Okay, so the motion is made by Councilmember Hanford and seconded by Councilmember Garian to direct staff to decline the grant. Councilmember Gamble? Gamble?
Wow.
You guys are murdered.
How do you have
Okay, so the alternative that's being proposed here is, okay, we want to go into reserves and we're going to pass on close to $1 million and we're going to submit later down the road. What's your gut there, Brad, that we're going to get money in the future down the road? Basically applying for the same thing.
It depends on if that money is available again. I mean, that's because this is federal money and it depends on federal appropriations and whether the pot comes up again. You know, it has been fairly consistent. It's probably more likely than not that we would get it later if money is available. And the other problem is if somebody else comes up with a better project. You know, in this set of projects that were submitted this ranked high, next time the money comes up, there may be higher ranking projects. So
sure,
that's
understood.
A risk.
What I actually heard there was that you feel pretty good that we could write in the future, and if there's funds there, you feel pretty good about our case.
Yeah.
I heard you were writing.
No, I'm just trying to gauge, hey, it is $1 million, right? And if it's one of those things where, this is just going to be a one-time thing, this fund's going to go away, and we're going to lose our opportunity, I'm more inclined to look and see, okay, what can we do? But if we feel like we can go at it again, then I'm going to lean towards more of Councilman Beery and Williams and Hanford, and I'm assuming Campbell.
Turns
light off.
Never assume you feel the road is
taken. We turn this light on. Why would I start driving? You might have a motorcycle.
Thank you. Councilmember Campbell.
I think we should defer it as well.
Okay, thank you. With that said, we will take a vote on the motion, and then all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, moving right along. We have a resolution for amending fees. Chief Quinzer. It's yours? Yes.
For amending fees?
Yeah. Yes.
My only way.
This is for the
right. The only difference between the current contract we have with them is an increase, I believe, of $3 per day. It's a 3-year contract. Very cost effective for the city.
Recommended action here tonight is a motion to adopt resolution 2012-017 establishing fees, fines, penalties, interest, and charges for 2012 to include the we have a $2 increase here.
$2? Sorry.
No clue.
Put the $1 for the Chief's benevolent fund.
I'm not sure who was first, so I'll go left to right. Councilmember Hanford.
I'd like to make a motion to adopt resolution 2012-017 establishing fees, fines, penalties, interest, and charges for 2012.
Second.
All right, motion's made by Councilmember Hanford, seconded by Councilmember Camp. Any questions for the chief?
$1? That's how much you get.
It adds up
per day.
He's worth about 25.
Jeez.
All right, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Authorize the mayor to sign extension of purchase and sale agreement with Savvy Corporation. Jeff.
So, Mayor, Council, action in front of you is a proposal to extend the purchase sale agreement with Savvy, or I should say North Kelsey LLC, on more well known as the Walmart site. I get to be here collecting some cash that Diane was earlier spending on the bond refunding, so I'll take the glory. Based on what the agreement states, as council has been informed in the past, is North Kelsey LLC and the City of Monroe agree to extend the purchase and sale agreement that would otherwise expire at the end of this month on June 30th. In essence, the terms of the extension boil down to simply we will extend the contract for 1 year, and we will grant North Kelsey LLC the option of 4 additional 3-month extensions for a total of a 2-year extension. The 1-year extension will be accompanied with a $99,000 payment to the City of Monroe. That will be paid within 14 days to escrow after the execution of this document. Within 30 days after that, that money will then be released to the city. Same type of circumstance would happen with each extension. Each extension would be 1/4 of the $99,000 or $24,975. The key provision here is we hope never to get to a year or to any extensions. The trigger is the closing date. The closing date will take place once, and I won't read it all, but in essence, once all the government approvals have been granted and all the appropriate appeal periods for those approvals have expired. So once we have gotten through the legal situation with Friends of North Kelsey and the appeal court appeal period has expired, or if Friends of North Kelsey was gracious enough to rescind their rescind their lawsuit, I guess would be the right desire, or if the appellate court was to, what is it? I was told it was the motion on merits, I believe is what Walmart has indicated they're going to ask for prior when the court moves forward in July in setting oral hearing dates. That would be a situation, and Zach can probably fill this in if I didn't say it wrong, but the situation, low percentage, I believe, that the court would just dismiss the case on the merits at the Superior Court level and grant relief to the city. More than likely, what will happen in July, we'll get a court date sometime in the future, 4 to 6 months. Good guess?
I think that's a rough roughly accurate estimate. My assumption, though, is that since the appellants, the Friends of North Kelsey Group, still get an opportunity for a reply brief that will in turn be served in July, I don't believe that we'll get a court date at that point. It probably will be sometime after that.
Understood. Okay. So the essence of the deal then is once all that stuff has expired, all the legal actions done, all the appeals to the legal actions are done, we have clear sailings. North Kelsey LLC and the City of Mineral will move to closing within 45 days after that period of time. And if that takes place in July, fine. If it may take place a year from now, it may take place 2 years from now. The contract anticipates any of those eventualities. So I leave it open to any questions you might have. And the action recommended is just an oral motion as described in the cover sheet.
Councilor Gary.
Thank you. Motion authorizing the mayor to execute the Second Amendment to the purchase agreement with North Kelsey LLC and substantiate the form presented to council together with such minor revisions as the mayor may deem necessary or appropriate.
Second. Motion was made by Councilmember Gary and seconded by Councilmember Gamble to authorize the mayor to execute the Second Amendment to the purchase agreement with North Kelsey LLC and substantiate the form presented to council together with such minor revisions as the mayor may deem necessary or appropriate. Yes.
If I could just add one more item. The financial remuneration considered in this contract is a good faith effort that was negotiated with the end user, actually. Walmart Corporation has agreed to work through the process with us and in good faith pay the interest on the bond debt that we're moving forward with. So that $99,000 figure is a good faith effort to show that Walmart is a partner with us in this, and the city has agreed to these terms to show that we're a partner with Walmart bringing the business forward. So the bond interest, or the interest on the $6.5 million bond, again, will be covered by that $99,000.
Unfortunate that we're at this point, but very grateful to Walmart and North Kelsey LLC for the partnership in creating this solution to the circumstance that we find ourselves in. Any other questions or comments for Mr. Sachs? All right, then all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We'll go around then real quick. Any council member reports tonight?
Not tonight, thank you. Yeah, I just have one question or suggestion, but it seems like there's a lot of stuff positive going on right now with Galaxy and H3O, North Galaxy. Is there a way we can put press releases on our website so that at least then when the newspapers poorly report what's going on, that there's something that they can link to? I've spent a lot of time this week just answering questions from friends and neighbors, and it's amazing how much misinformation is out there on some of the stuff that I think is really positive and exciting going on, and the papers are not going to report it. They're not going to report it fairly. They haven't reported it fairly, and I know they're both sitting right there. So if we could at least give them a press release or do something so we have some presence on our website, it would be helpful.
Sachs, we had a conversation, something similar to that earlier this week, or was it late last week?
Yeah, it was earlier this week. And it really comes down to time and the ability to put the information together. It needs to be done, I agree. And it's a focus of my attention.
I just think it would be very beneficial. I, you know, like I said, the article I saw for H3O said the city gets $25,000 a year rent. That's all. That's all it said. That was the positive financial. So people that read that, citizens that read that, look at it and think, well, that doesn't make sense. And so we have to do something to put our message out.
And I totally agree with you. My experience with reporters and editors are you can give the reporter 100% of the information. The reporter will write 100% of the information. They'll get a new advertisement for that page, and the editor will print 20% of the information.
Correct, but there's places where they can link to our press release or our website. People can just start getting trained to go to our website to get a bigger story that might have all the facts.
Very good.
City Administrator Brenzel.
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, and I'll work with Mr. Sachs as well on that. I did want to say that I went to the city manager's meeting today, and the article in the Herald, thanks to Alex and the crowd, generated a lot of discussion, a lot of jealousy among the other cities. That Monroe has a lot of businesses coming here, a lot of energy in Monroe, so I did want to thank Alex for that article. So.
All right, Councilmember Campbell.
Okay.
Councilmember Campbell.
To Councilmember Boone's point, is there? I know we've been doing. You know, I love the flashes on the upcoming meetings and you know, all that kind of stuff. And maybe it is just a, you know, as a part of that revolving flash that's on our website, it could be just a what's happening, or you know, even could be things in the news.
That's right.
You know, it could be a things in the news type of section where you can actually click on that and it'll go to a landing page that's within our website that's things in the news, so that we can have our stuff. You know, that would be a suggestion.
Yeah, I was just thinking that in the news.
That's right.
very good. Councilmember Hammer.
Yeah, I just agree with what's been said.
Okay.
Be green, yeah. That's all.
Staff, anything further to report, Mr. Sachs?
I was joking earlier about Diane spending the money and me getting to bring it in. I'm going to say this to the staff tomorrow or Thursday also when we got the council meeting. My job, I get to go out and talk about fun projects and progress. But if it wasn't for the city staff doing their job, police department, public works guys, and parks guys, city hall folk. You know, my job, it wouldn't be worth the time I'm putting into it. So, you know, when council talks about these projects, I joke with Jake a lot of times, you know, he brings in a $240,000 sweeper and you guys talk about it for 42 seconds and approve it. Somebody else might come in with $5,000 worth of something. It might take 2 weeks. So, you know, keep in mind that the city staff, you know, the core city functions that are taking place are really what the city's all about. And I'm really enjoying doing the job I'm doing, but at the same time, we have great staff here at City Hall.
Ben?
It's hard to follow that.
Yeah.
What's your HR to lose?
Yeah.
I actually voted for him.
Yeah.
I know that.
I'm sorry, real quick. Councilmember Camp?
Thank you. I just want to mention I read an article by Mr. Stone involving Mr. Sachs in the paper and dealing with Dream and Chamber and the relationship with the city. I would really appreciate more information in the future as hopefully things occur and progress. So if you could put that on your calendar to bring that periodically before us, I'd appreciate it. And good article. Thank you.
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you. Some news stuck in your mailbox is that press release. So I did send a press release out. And then when we do press releases, we put them on the newsflash on the website. So it's, but you have to go to the Parks and Rec page to find the newsflash. But anyways, that World Harmony Run I guess it's every other year. I learned a lot about it in the last couple of weeks. They contacted Jane, the city administrator, a couple weeks ago. So I've been working with the area Seattle coordinator. So it's a loop from New York City to New York City. Really kind of neat. They in their About World Harmony Run, it's a global relay. It seeks to promote international friendship, understanding. So as a symbol of the harmony, runners carry a flaming torch, passing it from hand to hand, traveling over 100 nations around the globe. The World Harmony Run does not seek to raise money or highlight any political cause, but just simply strives to create goodwill among people of all nations. So I think it's really neat. London Games happening in another month, that the route happens to come through Monroe. So we're going to be coming north on 522. We're going to have an exit, Main Street. Come to Main Street, we're going to stop here. And Greek mayor and some area scouts will also be there. And they'll be outside if the weather lets us. If not, we'll try not to set off the fire alarm or the torch. We're not going to bring them in here. So 10:50 a.m. is when they're approximately supposed to arrive. So we'll be looking for them. It's going to be a neat little thing. So then we have a couple of next 2 weekends, the wakeboard events, Northwest Riders this weekend, and Mastercraft Pro Tour the following weekend.
Chief?
Yes. Hopefully, some of you noticed on the three major news television stations the last 2 days, and also was in the Herald, too, about the our school resource officer made the arrest on nine juveniles that had committed over $50,000 worth of damage, including breaking into Frank Wagner school and damage a lot of electronics, computers, etc. But one of the things that I really I couldn't believe happened, and maybe you even saw some pictures of it, was they broke in twice to the Galaxy Theater and ripped screens, a screen, ripped up a lot of the upholstery chairs in there and the like. But through the school resource officers started putting some things together, and he did an excellent job on it. He was also on the Dory Monson show today, but I'm really proud of the job that he did. And I would also like to, there's a couple parents who had their children arrested that stepped forward and really supported the police department. We don't find that all the time these days, and they are to be commended.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Mr. Albert, getting to bring?
Two things. One is the letter has gone off to the post office requesting the address change. So we should have the answer at your July 10th council meeting. And the other one is, don't forget, it's amateur radio field day. So when you're out looking at the big borders, you can come by and say hi.
Yes. On Saturday.
On Saturday. Yes.
Diane?
Nothing.
I'll smile at that last bit of action. Yeah. All right, very good. Busy weekends. A lot of good things, as Councilmember Williams pointed out. Very excited about what's going on here. The company that we spoke of a couple weeks ago, escrow did close, and a new manufacturing facility is in the process of now moving into Monroe with the intentions of bringing as many as 350 to 400 jobs in total eventually. So we're very excited about that. And things continue to happen. Staff continue to respond to the inquiries and to the opportunities, and pass those off to them. I was out speaking with some folks, and it's just a highlight to Brad and his department. People were mentioned by name, Kim for one, just with respect to the level of service and support that they have been receiving in their application processes and project processes. And so thank you to you and your staff. And I said it a couple years ago, Monroe is open for business. It certainly is. And we're seeing the fruits of the labor here, of the folks that are sitting out here in the audience, and those who are not in attendance tonight. But we're moving in a very different and positive direction. So, City Administrator Brasner?
Yeah, I'm just all smiles.
Yeah.
I'm having fun being the administrator. And when I showed up at the meeting today, I think the comment was, oh, come on, an ice arena? So, at any rate, everybody is jealous of us, and that's a good place to be. So hats off to everybody here as well. So draft agenda, July 10th, 2012. Announcement, some presentations. We have a presentation by the Fire District number 3 regarding the levy, proposed levy. Chief Silva will be here for that. We have the consent agenda. Under new business, we have private use of city property. Under final action, we have the ordinance adopting comprehensive plan amendments, second and final reading. Number 2, authorized right-of-way purchased East Fremont Street utility replacement project. And then we have, under study session topics, the department reports and the draft agenda for July 17th. Any additions or deletions?
We do have the need for an executive session this evening. City Attorney Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. A very brief executive session. Pursuant to RCW 42-3-1-10-1-I, the purpose of the executive session is to discuss litigation of legal counsel. The executive session will last approximately 5 minutes, and the council is not anticipated to take any action in open session except if only adjourned meeting.
All right. With that said, then, we will go into the executive session for 5 minutes. Hey, Councilmember Camp.
Second.
Motion's been made by Councilmember Camp and seconded by Councilmember Gearney. To adjourn, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Sam.
That was quick, Kevin. That was quick.